Let me adjust my posture.
Yep.
What's the name of that cushion with the that truck drivers use for their bottoms?
My back feels good and my bottom feels
good. My bottom feels good. I need a podcast cushion for my bottom.
And I need a chillo.
Yeah.
For my chill. Lady problems.
Yes. Oh. Now I'm not angry at Ted Cruz anymore.
We all need a chillo.
Yeah. Everybody needs to take a chillo. You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for October 18th, 2013. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the bleeding heart liberal end of the great national centrism survey spectrum, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
And yes, I did fill out that Tiger Beat survey of 10 reasons why you're not a centrist.
Oh, see, I thought it was the 10 sexy things you can do to sex up your sex time, because it was Esquire.
Well, it was... All the great people are centrists, and then there's these fringe people who are, you know, in the minority. So let's be mean to them.
Yeah.
Not surprisingly, was a bleeding heart.
Yeah. You know who I discovered really hates centrism, Blue Gal? Really hates it? Turns out Charlie Pierce hates centrism.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, he wrote a very exciting post about how awful centrism is and how bad centrists are and how it's just the same old douchebags who've been pitching this no-label nonsense forever, and they're just going to keep getting jobs forever and ever because centrism is just awful, 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 terrible. It's where political cowards and scoundrels go to hide.
He's one of our listeners, apparently.
Apparently he is. So
for him. Hi there, Charlie.
Hey, Charlie.
Nice to have you on board.
Yeah.
Do you have any other predictions you want to make for the coming months?
So I have 12 predictions. The first is on the Sunday morning shows, there'll probably be a brief flurry of recriminations, something like what happened after Iraq. But there'll also be sort of a grudging acknowledgement that something, some fraction of the Republican Party, very small fraction, are crazy in the same way Abby Hoffman was crazy. But those crazy people, they're very sincere. You have to admit that. They're very, very sincere. And they're trying to do the right thing as far as they can perceive the right thing.
Do you mean Congressman Abby Hoffman, chairman of the House Budget Committee back in the 60s? Oh, okay.
House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Abby Hoffman.
Oh, yeah.
Who shut the Pentagon down and had it disassembled and sunk into the ocean. I distinctly remember that. The second prediction is that there will be one or two people you might mistake for liberals in a dark room if you were drunk. And those TV liberals will cluck their tongues knowingly and go, tisk, tisk, tisk. I'm guessing it's E.J. Dionne, but that's just my guess.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to a miracle of timing, Senator-elect Cory Booker, who is very cautious and centrist and doesn't like to say mean things about people on either side of the aisle, will have a chance to count coup very lightly on the GOP and with absolutely no risk of him being mistaken for a liberal. So he'll take that chance. He'll say some bad things about the GOP because for the next week, there's zero risk of that blowing back at you as a liberal. After which, he will plead for a return to the good old days when reasonable people in both parties ignored the extremes on both sides. Blah, 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 blah. In general, there'll be an overwhelming compulsion for the media to zip past the recent unpleasantness as fast as possible. And so within a week to 10 days, our press will be right back rooting around for hippies to blame half of everything on. They'll be ably led by David Gregory, who will put his shoulder right back into pushing that both sides narrative with all kinds of gusto. Prediction number six, our friends at MSNBC will bounce up and down angrily at the media, and when we say media, we mean Fox News or CNN, in their complicity in shoving all this stuff down the memory hole. Our friends of MSNBC will also studiously avoid mentioning that many of their colleagues at MSNBC and NBC are leading the charge to shove this bale of nonsense down the memory hole. The left will continue to be ignored, number seven, wholesale, even as indignant conservatives in exile continue to expropriate our entire Book of Common Prayers. Andrew Sullivan will continue to write like a liberal circa 1994, to the delight of his hundreds of thousands of daily listeners and 30,000 paid subscribers. David Frum will continue his job at the Daily Beast for no apparent reason and remain fixated on the year 2009 as the moment the conservatives lost their mind and he was forced to leave on principle. David Brooks will continue to remain on book leave, whatever the hell that is, and will continue to take breaks from his vacation so he can tell America about heroism and centrism and how it's all bad and how everyone should listen to the sober minds on both sides of the aisle on NPR and PBS. Like every other doomsday cult, the GOP will return from the desert, chastise the vile material world for causing some of the faithful to waver. They will decry the postponing of the apocalypse, reconsult scripture, and begin laying the groundwork for their next chance to bring down the United States government, which will happen in 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And this one's a long shot, and I mentioned at the top of the podcast, but I'm pretty sure sooner or later Charlie Pierce will start writing about my mom, which won't bother me nearly as much as the 190 commenters who will go by his place and say, thank God someone finally is writing about Drift Glass's mom.
Yes. Amen.
Those are my 12 predictions for the upcoming apocalypse. And thank goodness the apocalypse has been postponed until after my birthday. So,
hey, and yeah, your birthday's coming up at the end of this month.
Yeah. So I get to have one more birthday before the zombies take over, which is great. It's just so sad. And I'm just over here pounding 10 grain, just like, okay, whatever, man. 10 grain is the blogger who's been writing about Peggy Noonan since 1812.
Yeah.
And he's really good and writes really well. And his cartoons are good. And he set the frame up and he sort of developed the Noonan vocabulary for discussing Peggy Noonan. And I've been doing commentary on the Sunday morning talk show, the Sunday morning gas bags, the Sunday morning roundup, the Sunday morning mouse circus, in a feature called Sunday Morning Coming Down since 2005. I've been writing about David Brooks since 2005, Andrew Sullivan, David Gregory, on and on and on, since 1812. And about a year and a half ago, Charlie Pierce decided he wanted to write about David Brooks, and his stuff sounds just astonishingly like mine. Not that he's plagiarizing, it's just he uses the same vocabulary.
He's tilling in exactly the same field you are, with the same opinions, and frankly,
and
the same level of talent. I mean,
he's a very good writer, and the same framing, the same kind of positioning of this person in the spectrum, the same analysis of where his faults are and what exactly he's up to. And then Charlie decided he'd write about Andrew Sullivan, and then Charlie decided he'd write about the Sunday shows, and then Charlie decided he'd write about David Gregory. And I thought centrism was still safely mine, but apparently not. So
stop, Driftglass's mother.
Not my mom will now become Charlie. And it wouldn't bother me at all if I actually got paid to write anything. But I'm sorry,
I'm not laughing at you not getting paid to write anything. No. I'm laughing because
that's ever going to happen.
It's true.
And I like Charlie Pierce. I like him on Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's funny and he's insightful. But really, like 5 or 6 or 12 or 15 of my readers had to really go bang his head like a gong when he started writing about David Brooks in a way that was indistinguishable from me. Mm-hmm. To say, look, man, if you're going to come onto this territory, you really got to acknowledge that there's been a guy writing about David Brooks since way the hell back.
And
in the
you at least, days. Yeah. And I was one of the people. I mean, we've talked about this on a previous podcast, but if he was just writing for Esquire and it was in Esquire and that was it, I was going to be okay with that.
Yeah.
But he had a blog role.
Yeah.
And you weren't on it.
He had a blog role and
like,
he had.
And he had Duncan Black on it and Digby and he didn't have you. It's like, dude, if you're going to write like Driftglass, you at least have to acknowledge he exists, you know? So.
And he's sort of gone down all the beats that.
When he does link you from time to time.
No, Charlie, once. He did once over something. And I'm grateful for that.
And he mentions you, the Book of Driftglass.
But what's.
We must read from the Book of Driftglass.
Yeah. And what's pretty clear is whether it's magazine policy or not, this is just sort of marketing reality. This is not, either here nor there. But this is. There's a line above which. If you will be linked, or you'll be acknowledged, or you'll be shot a link to, and no matter what you do or say, there's a certain professional threshold.
And I think that line is somewhere in the Philadelphia suburbs.
Yeah, it
frankly.
Is. It really
and
is.
And east.
It is. And so you will see Andrew Sullivan, who now writes like a liberal circa 1994, mm-hmm. pretty much straight up. I mean, Andrew Sullivan is simply mass purloining. Or expropriating the liberal critique of conservatism, again, en masse. His if you shut out the fact that he's a conservative gay blogger who was a Bush supporter for a real long time and used to bash liberals for a living, you could not distinguish stuff that Andrew Sullivan writes from what Digby was writing 10 years ago, mm-hmm. or I was writing 10 years ago, which is fine. The only problem is the liberals have disappeared from the liberal critique of conservatism. Mm-hmm. Andrew Sullivan doesn't acknowledge liberals exist at all.
Yeah.
He simply links to fellow conservatives who are also very frustrated with the conservative movement, who also all sound suspiciously like liberals did 10 years ago. Sincerely, this particular piece, I'm frustrated about a lot of other things. This sincere piece is not special pleading for me. Oh, poor, poor, sorry me. You know, we have on this podcast so far 1,681,400 listens.
Yeah, and we do not have a dollar for each listen either, no. or a penny.
No, we don't have a penny for each. But we have a lot of people listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
And a lot of people still read me. It's a fairly occult group of people, and there's a subset of them who are basically wait for me to say something mean about Glenn Greenwald so they can jump into the comment section and call me a poopy head. But there's a group, and there's a plan, and it's still kind of fun to do. But there is this is what sort of the subtext of a lot that we're going to be talking about this week. There is an amazing expropriation of liberal chapter and verse by the mainstream media and by this is the government shutdown. The oh my God, they're crazy. Oh my God, they're run by fundamentalists. Oh my God, they really are reckless and destructive. Oh my God, they really are out to destroy America. Mm-hmm. There's this expropriation of what has been the liberal canon, the liberal critique, the liberal textbook, liberal 101 on conservatism for 30, 40 years. And now they're page by page, that critique is being taken over temporarily, mind you, because they'll go right back to blaming both sides in a week or two.
Well, and we want to know when, you know, I want to have a bet with you because you won the last bet of when Newt Gingrich was going to be back on the TV. Yep. I had said 4th of July and you said, oh, no, June 1st. And you won. Yeah. He was back within 30 days.
Yeah, always. There's a reset button somewhere in the NBC tower, the corporate that they're pressing. OK, all right. The GOP has once again nearly destroyed the country. We have to allow at least 10 days of pretending that we give a shit about that before we go back to blaming hippies for half of everything that goes wrong. And it's usually about 10 days. It's usually, you know, one full Sunday to Sunday news cycle. And then we're back to talking about how both sides are this and both sides are that. But during this brief interregnum, and enjoy it, liberals, enjoy it, because it happens so rarely. When your ideas and your critiques and your all the things you've been saying about conservatives and Republicans are friggin' vindicated. Mission accomplished. Except enjoy it while you can. Because within about 10 days, all that will be forgotten. It'll all be swept back under the rug.
And we'll
be back to both sides doing it.
Well, and I almost want to keep a printout of the vote to reopen the government with me at all times.
Yeah.
To just say, both sides, really? Because look here. Who voted to reopen the government and who didn't?
Or just keep the number, because remember, and this will be forgotten in the news media in the next 10 days.
In the next, I'd say 4 days.
It's not just the people in the Senate. The majority of Republicans in the House voted to destroy the economy. Remember that. The overwhelming majority of Republicans in the House voted to keep the government shut down and to default on our debt. Mm-hmm. It was the Democrats who were the majority. Who carried the day? It was Nancy Pelosi. It was Speaker Pelosi who saved this country from default. The majority of the people in the House, the majority of Republicans in the House would have been perfectly content to drive us over the bridge, drive us right off the cliff. And that will be forgotten within 10 days or so. And so enjoy it while you can, but listen carefully to how much the people in the media through gritted teeth are going to acknowledge that there is something fundamentally broken about the Republican Party in words that could have been written by any liberal for the last 30 years, and listen to the fact that they will not, if you put a friggin' gun to their head, will not acknowledge liberals exist or that they were right. Yeah. And that's the core of my critique of this, is I've seen this happen 3 or 4 times now, actually 7 or 8 times now, going back to the Clinton, actually 20 or 30 times now, if you can go back far enough. And it will always end the same way, which is there's a brief acknowledgement that, well, something went wrong, and yeah, they were pretty bad, and let's get back to beating up hippies, because that's what we're comfortable doing. So enjoy this brief hiatus from the constant pressure to prove that liberals are relevant as conservatives spout liberal cant and dogma without ever acknowledging liberals exist.
Exactly. And I want to mention, too, that being called a bleeding heart I consider a compliment.
Yeah. Why blue gal?
It's comparing you to Jesus and his sympathy for the poor. And I had some troll on Twitter who I went and checked out to make sure he really was just a troll. And he was saying things like, oh, Jon Stewart, you're on vacation. That's okay. Your show is getting stale. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, you're not going to get a response from me. But he, this troll, said to me, it's not my job to take care of you from cradle to grave.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And okay,
let's see what the book said.
It's pretty darn easy to find Bible verses that talk about people's responsibility to the poor.
Yeah, and it just involves stomping on them, apparently.
The one I liked that I found first when I was looking for one was from Romans, where Paul is talking to the Romans about where he's going on his trips, and he says, first, I'm going to Jerusalem to deliver a relief offering to the followers of Jesus there. The Greeks decided they wanted to take up a collection for the poor among the believers in Jerusalem. They were happy to do this, but it was also their duty. Seeing that they got in on all the spiritual gifts that flowed out of the Jerusalem community so generously, it is only right that they do what they can to relieve their poverty. And yeah, I mean, it's their duty to do this, and it's your duty to do this. And people will come back and say, well, yeah, but it's not the government's job. It's like, who is the government? This is what we're learning. This is the learning process we're going through with the closing of government.
Well, some of us are.
Yeah.
Well, some of us sort of understand the government is us.
Yeah. The government is us, folks.
But for them, the government is you. Yeah. Is you people stealing people. My money to give it to those,
People.
Those ungrateful, brown, lazy people.
Yep.
That the government is an occupying army that's stealing my stuff and giving it away to bad people.
Yep.
And that is why I'm morally justified in destroying it for Jesus.
And that poor woman who was hauled off the House floor last night, as soon as the vote passed, yelling about the Freemasons writing the Constitution or not writing the Constitution and God is great. And she really lost it. And but what she was arguing, as one of my email friends pointed out, is a real theological thing. She's not just spouting craziness. Her theology was creative destruction from God,
right?
The form of the Tea Party,
right?
Yeah.
Well, I dinged him a couple of minutes ago, and I would like to compliment Charlie Pierce now by saying that he pointed out that everyone knows you're not allowed to shout crazy in Congress until you're elected by the people of the great state of Texas. But there is absolutely zero theological difference between the crazy stuff Michelle Bachmann says, the crazy stuff that Ted Cruz invokes, the crazy stuff Louis Gohmert says, and what the crazy lady who was the recorder or stenographer was saying. Absolutely none at all.
None.
They all believe the same thing. It all comes out of that deep, crazy swamp of Tea Party, fundamentalist, paranoid conspiracy theories, and they are the majority of the minority. They're the majority of the majority party in the House.
Mm-hmm.
And but for Nancy Pelosi, today the federal government would still be shut down.
Yep.
And today the U.S. would be in default, and people would be fleeing from our currency and our name because we have become a third world country that can't govern itself.
Right. Right. You just said something nice about Charlie Pierce. I want to say something nice about Chris Hayes.
Yes.
Chris Hayes had a open house on Twitter after his show on Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
And I had a question ready for him before his Tuesday night episode, which was about this study, this report out by the Public Accountability Initiative, where certain people like former Bush administration official Stephen Hadley had been trotted out on Sunday shows and cable news to talk about Syria and arguing for military intervention in Syria, while at the same time being an officer on the board of Raytheon.
Yeah.
And owning himself personally about $875,000 worth of stock in Raytheon.
Yeah.
Which manufactures Tomahawk cruise missiles, which would obviously be used in any attack on Syria. So I wanted to ask Chris Hayes, why would NBC and his network allow former officials to come on without saying something about who they worked for and who they were benefiting from in terms of their stock portfolios at the very least? And or at least know, you know, when you may not know people's stock portfolios, but you know if they're on the board of Raytheon.
Yeah.
That's just, I mean, that's public knowledge. And to his credit, before I got a chance to type in my question on Twitter after his show, he had on Blanche Lincoln, former Senator Blanche Lincoln.
Yep. Yep.
And absolutely to his credit, he took 20 seconds to talk about her now being a lobbyist, who she worked for, and the fact that one of her clients was Walmart.
Yep.
And you can then listen to her with that information in the back of your head. Uh-huh. And she was just available, I guess, and spouting conventional wisdom about the shutdown. Oh, they're all crazy. They don't have a goal. Ted Cruz led them down a golden path and abandoned them. And, you know, she didn't say anything that everyone else hasn't already said. But if she was talking about anything to do with Walmart, we would know ahead of time because Chris Hayes told us.
Yes.
This is what she does for a living. And that's all that's required.
Exactly. That's all that's required. I mean, I am, again, floored over and over again the number of times that Chris Hayes gives a tongue bath to Ben Dominic.
I know.
Except as you pointed out, as they were talking to each other, you pointed out.
Yeah, I had never really listened to Ben Dominic before before Wednesday night. And when I listened to him, I realized, oh, people like people like themselves. And he's having this young, articulate guy who doesn't raise his voice, doesn't monopolize the conversation, and can speak from a conservative position, who is his age and obviously a buddy of his from Chicago days. And so obviously he's going to have Ben on and be nice to him because Ben serves all kinds of purposes that fill up a card.
Right. Because Michael Steele was busy that day.
So. Yeah. Well, he's willing to do the job. And you know, that's why they have Newt Gingrich on. Newt Gingrich will speak in sound bites, will speak conventional wisdom, won't go off the reservation there. He will at the Faith and Freedom Conference. But apparently you're allowed to separate those. You're totally allowed to say one thing in front of Faith and Freedom, another thing on Twitter, and another thing on the Sunday shows, and you're not supposed to cross the streams at all.
And that really is a thing.
That really is a thing. Yeah.
I there's nothing in the show about Glenn Greenwald this week, and there will continue not to be.
Well, that's fine. But yeah, he's a perfect example of you'll have him on Chris Hayes and he'll talk about privacy. And then you don't ask him anything about all the really nasty things he said to people on Twitter.
Yeah. Or the actual lies he's told.
The actual lies he's told on Twitter. Yeah.
Or actual lies he told on television.
Yeah.
Which are pretty easily documented about, you know, the fate of whistleblowers. And there's this gentleman's agreement. I'm not sure what the appropriate, you know, term is for the 21st century, but there's obviously this gentleman's agreement that what you say on Twitter stays on Twitter. What you say on some other channel stays on another channel, which would be fine if 10 minutes later, MSNBC weren't ripping into Fox News for what Fox News people say on Fox News.
Yeah.
Okay, so what you said in front of a camera over there counts. But what you said in front of the camera over there, we're going to ignore that. And that's the sort of the deal you have to accept when you go, you know, when you turn on MSNBC. Chris Hayes is really good. He does a really good job. I'm right with him on lots of things. Mm-hmm. Then he or Rachel Maddow or someone else will make this extraordinarily deferential U-turn to avoid asking one of their colleagues a hard question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's when you're like, okay.
But you and I have it very easy. We have an hour to fill every week,
uh-huh.
and we can talk about anything we want.
Yes.
We don't, you know, we pay for that by not having Rachel Maddow's salary.
That's true.
But her job is to fill that, 48 minutes every night?
Yeah.
And she has to fill it with something that's going to make the suits at NBC not cancel her show.
Right. And that's,
so,
it's not that, no, I don't have
nobody's going to cancel this show.
Right.
And except us.
Yeah. Well, but my point being, like patenting or copywriting the term fair and balanced so that you can lie and call yourself fair and balanced because that's just our trademark name. MSNBC really does market itself as the truth-driven, fact-based, relentless purveyor of reality.
Mm-hmm.
That is the contra, that is the good twin of Fox News. Yeah. And it oftentimes is that. And then out comes this sort of like, and we're not going to talk about David Gregory, who's our colleague, but we can't really call him a douchebag. We're going to rail against the media and how the media does false equivalences, but we're never going to mention that the number one offender is the guy down the hall from me in that big office. We're never going to mention that Mark Halperin, who we have to sort of be nice to at Christmas parties and we have to have on our show every now and then, is a giant douche and a tool and a fraud. because we're not allowed to do it.
We're not going to talk about where the no labels money comes from.
No, generally. We're not going to talk about Mark McKinnon and his weird background. We're just going to put him on the air every now and then to talk about both sides and centrism. Yeah. And the thing I admire about Chris doing this with Blanche Lincoln is you stick a label under those people.
Yeah.
You know, he put a label under Blanche Lincoln saying, here's where she's coming from. If you would put a label under Ben Dominic saying, this guy works for and is paid by a right-wing outfit that is the premier climate denier organization in America. By the way, Chris, how do you feel about climate deniers?
Yeah.
Well, you know, he works for the healthcare end of that. Okay. He works for the good part of the tobacco industry, not the bad part. By the way, the Heartland Institute got its money from the Tobacco Institute and tobacco money until it flipped over to petroleum money from the climate deniers. So stick a label under him. This is the guy who was canned for plagiarism. This is the guy who, you know, who took money for writing press releases for foreign governments and on and on and on. Then I'll listen to him.
Yeah.
But this, you know, he's a conservative working for a think tank. No, you say that because he's your friend.
Yeah.
And anyway, I've gotten off the
rails. No, that's okay. But that's the point. That's the point. All right. You saw Casablanca this week again.
I did.
Tell us about that.
Well, I think it's going to go places. I think it's
you came home. I said, how was the movie? Oh, it was pretty good.
Yeah. The feel good hit of 1942. It's going to, I think it's a sleeper, but it's going to hit. Going to hit big.
You took Junior Dude.
I did. I took Junior Dude and watched it at a church. We didn't have time to chat about it much before or after, but there was a really intense movie guy there doing the facilitation. And he's really always fun to talk to. And I was still struck by how incredibly timely it is. What a really good story it is. I try to watch it once a year. And it's really worth your time. It is everything I like about movies. And there's just things you notice, you know, as you see it two or three or four times, first of all, it was written and it was filmed while America was losing World War II. This is not shot after America had won the war. This was shot while America was getting its ass kicked in the war. And nobody was sure who was going to win. At least, you know, the public was, you know, not really clear on how this was going. So there's this, you know, terrible force sweeping the world. And there's this guy who's fought on the good guy's side over and over again and gotten his ass kicked over and over again. And he finally finds a little happiness with a woman who deserts him. And he just says, screw it. Opens up a bar in Casablanca. And as he says, you know, it's a good place. I plan to die here. It's a good place for it. But this isn't sort of a sermon about bucking up and feeling good. It's just there's a lot of really good moral lessons embedded in there. There's the lesson about picking sides.
Yeah.
There's a moment when you know, there's the battle of the bands. The Germans are singing, I think, Watch on the Rhine, and everyone's dispirited and demoralized. And the leader of the movement, Victor Laszlo, tells the band to play Le Marseillaise. Mm-hmm. Play it. But they won't do it until Rick nods, until he gives them the okay. Because for all of your leadership, you got to have Rick on your side, too. For all of the, you know, all of the sort of ideological purity and energy and intellectual weight and leadership that Victor Laszlo has, you can't win without Bogart on your side. You can't win without the guy who has just had it finally picking a side and saying, all right, the stakes are high enough. I'm picking a side. And there's a moment where he and Ilse have talked over what's going on and they've spent the night together, apparently, or a big part of the night together.
Mama got a what?
We're pretty sure. They did more than kiss and talk about the good old days in Paris. But she asks him, she tells him she doesn't know what to do anymore. She's, you know, she can't make up her mind. She doesn't know what to do. She doesn't have the strength to leave him again. You'll have to decide for us. You'll have to decide for all of us. And at that moment, Rick says, I will. Mm-hmm. And Rick accepts moral responsibility for everything that happens after that. He is going to be the actor. He's going to decide where we go. And he sets in motion a lot of plans that come to fruition at the end of the movie. But there's just an awful lot of good moments in that movie about good, common, ordinary people who are terrified, who are outnumbered, who are outgunned. The confidence of the leaders that it doesn't matter because it doesn't matter if you kill me, Laszlo said, because if you did, thousands of millions would rise up and take my place. Even Nazis can't kill that fast. It's essentially a very confident movie. Mm-hmm. It says eventually the good guys will win. Eventually, the good guys will finally pick a side and finally push back. And we don't know how this is going to end, but we do know that you and Louie are going off to be pals. But there's just lovely little writerly moments in there. And it's a funny movie. It's got humor. You know, it's got Rick being Rick. And it's it was a very uplifting thing. And the lovely parts where when Rick casts his girlfriend aside with, "I never planned that far ahead." Remembering that's what Ilsa told him in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
That he uses her words to stick it to every woman he's with from now on. And they're just there, and I never planned that far ahead. And the lovely Shakespearean touch of the play within the play. The young woman who is there with her fiancé, fleeing from Belgium, because the devil has the people by the throat. And yet it costs so much. And she's about to do a terrible thing. She's about to sleep with Louis to get their exit visas. And she asks Rick's advice. And she does that lovely Shakespearean play within a play thing. She asks him exactly the question that has been haunting him, which is, "I'm about to do this terrible thing, but it would be okay if I never told my fiance about it, right? Because it's the only way I can save us. And he's such a child, he wouldn't understand. But that would be okay, right? Because that would save us, right? And it's okay because if you love someone enough, that's okay, right?" And Rick's answer, which just breaks your heart, is, "Nobody ever loved me that much."
Oh.
And it's just, oh, man, you know? See that movie 30 times. And it just gets me every time that he is that broken.
Yep.
And then
the part where Ilsa does confess that she loves him.
She does. She does.
She's gonna shoot him, gonna just shoot about. Him.
And he walks right up to the barrel of the gun and says, "Just do it. You'd be doing me a favor." Mm-hmm. And she can't do it. And that completely stuns him because he has completely misunderstood her. He's completely misread her. Mm-hmm. And now he understands what it was she did and why she did it and how she is the same person he fell in love with. And he is sort of the same person she fell in love with. And what are you going to do now? Because the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. And just, this is a movie review of a movie that's 70 years old. And it's worth your time. It's a wonderful movie. Go now.
Rent
Casablanca.
And I wanted to bring it up in light of the whole Tea Party thing too.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lesson in there for those of us who are doing battle again and feeling a sense of defeat, even in the jaws of victory, that, oh God, this is going to happen again and again.
And only thing we won was sequester.
Yes.
You know?
Right. That, you know, what we won is austerity.
Right.
And I agree with, who's that young guy who's always on Chris Hayes? He's the conservative who's shaved his mustache and beard off now.
Oh, Josh Barrow?
Josh Barrow, and he's working out. You can tell he's working out and doing the spray tan. He looks wonderful.
Lifts and squats, blue gal. Lifts and squats.
Lifts and squats and three steroids. Okay.
He's got three supplements, blue gal.
You jonesing on my supplements there, Drift
Flats? Hey, you're skinny fat, Chris Hayes. You're skinny fat.
we're quoting from Tosh.0. Anyway.
Shame on us.
I know. Bad feminist. Josh Barrow said on Twitter last night that this is the perfect coda to this whole drama, is that Mitch McConnell got $2.9 billion out of this deal for Kentucky.
Yeah.
In earmarks.
The B with a billion with a B.
Billion with a B. And what I thought was so funny about this, to me, I'm just irony of ironies.
Yeah.
It's for a dam project.
Yeah.
And remember a few weeks ago we were quoting Nixon Land?
Yes. Yes.
And the book Nixon Land by
Rick.
Rick Perlstein. Thank you.
Rick Perlstein. Friend of the podcast, friend of ours.
Friend of ours, Rick Perlstein's book, Nixon Land, talks where he's talking about how Nixon approached the economy and elections and said, and this was a quote, "Look, if job numbers aren't good enough right before the election, we'll just build a dam."
Yeah. Yeah. It's easy. It's not that. And you know what? And then we'll have a dam.
Yeah, and then we'll have a dam and we'll have some jobs and we'll have, that's all we're going to do. We're just going to throw some money at this. And I was upset about Mitch McConnell, and I got this from a fellow liberal, Jamie, who blogs at Intoxination. And he wrote me and said, did you see that Mitch McConnell got this money? But Mitch McConnell will turn off funding for a bridge that connects Kentucky to Ohio.
Uh-huh.
But he's for his dam project, which isn't going to do anybody any good. He's more than willing to find funding for that. And so I was saying, oh, this is an outrage. This is an outrage. Until I saw the number of teabaggers on Twitter were absolutely losing their minds over this, just losing their shit. Of being stabbed in the back by Mitch McConnell, and we've got to get him out of there, and we got to, you know, he's evil, and this is, and the fact that to them, any government spending, bridges, dams, jobs programs, healthcare, Obamacare, any of it is all evil.
It is. It's all evil, because that's what the Bible says.
And
Yeah, I know, but apparently it does. So, and they're very good Christians, so they just know that it's just all evil, and they
it must
just
be in the Bible because I believe it. And Rush Limbaugh said, told me.
And you know, just
they really don't make any distinction between the stuff that goes in their ears from Rush Limbaugh and the stuff that goes into their ears at church on Sunday, because all of it is certain.
It's all certain, and they're a doomsday cult, and you know they just because. You know, and it's just like a doomsday cult. Yeah. It's not possible that they got the apocalypse wrong. It's only possible that somebody in the midst wasn't faithful enough, or there was a rounding error in their calculation, and they'll get it right next time, or they're going to go right back to doing it again. But they're not going to quit. What the thing that infuriates me about our media, right from the top all the way down, is not that they ignore liberals per se. I'd be happy if they just took our critique and ran with it for more than, you know, two laps. You run the whole race with it, and then you'll never hear from me again. Andrew Sullivan, write a couple of columns that liberals are right and I was wrong, and liberals have been right since I was a boy, and boy, did I ever fuck this up. You'll never hear from me again. But the thing that infuriates me is that this notion that, oh, well, now that they've learned their lesson, the only thing the last 40 years have proven is they never learned their lesson. They're zombies. They always come back.
What's depressing about this, though,
and it is not the fault of the zombies that they keep attacking. Yeah. It's the fault of the idiots who say, well, I guess we're in the clear now, Steve, and stand up and light a cigarette and get their head taken off. That's the moron who needs to be taken out of the picture. And that moron is usually David Gregory. Well, now that the crisis is past, let's go on talking about how hippies are awful.
Well, and that's what the lesson of Casablanca to me is. At the end, Louis is still as corrupt as he was at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
We'll round up the usual suspects. Whatever. We'll jail somebody.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who.
But now he's picked a side.
He's picked a side.
It's not that he's become a much better person. He's still a lech. He's still a pervert. He's still a drunk.
Yeah.
But he's now decided he's not going to go with the prevailing wind.
Right.
He's not just going to go whichever way gets him into the Chevy Chase Country Club. There's actually a moral position here that's at stake that you actually have to fight for, because it's worth fighting for. And again, I do not blame the doomsday cultists. I don't blame the Limbaugh listeners. I blame them for being stupid and for being sheep and for being that friggin' impervious to reason and hiding out. I mean, these aren't people who are boldly walking their conservatism around anymore. They hide out behind this shield because their conservatism is so weak it can't stand the sight of day. But I get it. They're gone. We've said this 1,000 times. They're disappeared from the equation. Don't ever think you're going to get them back again. The people who are to blame for this are the people who keep insisting that they don't exist.
Both sides do.
Or that both sides are equally wrong.
Yep.
Or the finally we've seen the last of them. And every time the zombies come back, these people act shocked again.
Like it's a new thing.
Right. Or they put, hey, look, they put on tricorder hats this time. This must be a whole new group of people. No, it's the same friggin' group of base idiots who voted for Reagan
And you should be smart enough to know that because you've been in this business for long enough to have seen them before.
And
yes,
the thing
absolutely is,
they goddamn well knew better.
Yeah.
They went ahead and went with the, hey, a tea party. It's a whole bunch of different people. They went with that story because .. The why of that is the most important question in journalism and the place where you can stick a crowbar and pry people like David Gregory out of power. Get him off the air. Make people like that pay really dearly for lying to us and continually dragging Newt Gingrich back on the air and dragging Wayne LaPierre back on the air. Find out why he keeps doing that and apply direct pressure to that vein, and he will stop doing it. But until he stops allowing these people to come back on television, refurbish their reputation and be turned back loose into the public. This cycle is never going to stop. It's only going to keep ratcheting rightward. Anyway.
Well, and I do think the serious pushback with Chuck Todd of it's not my job. It's the White House's job to sell this thing. It's not my job to show the truth. And there was so much pushback on that. I do think that Chuck Todd was shaken by that. So,
But I got to say, 180,000 signatures later.
Yeah.
MSNBC has not apologized or even acknowledged that he did anything wrong.
I know. And it might be, as you say, a matter of days, if not hours, before Chuck Todd comes back on and says, well, you know, the Republicans have to do a better job. We have to polish this turd, as Heather says. Yeah. Thank God we've got a year to polish this turd before the election.
And so, well, yeah. So the over and under is, you know, what the betting pool is now. What is the next fake crisis the conservatives will invent to distract the media? I'm guessing flag burning. English only. We'll go back to Benghazi. That's a perennial that just never dies. The IRS is is the next completely bogus crisis or bogus?
I'm also waiting for the first actual elected official, not talking head, actual elected official to say the problem with the Congress is we aren't conservative enough.
Yeah. Well, that's already happened.
Yeah.
That's already happened. Yeah. If you go check my blog out, Talking Points Memo had one Republican lawmaker who said, yeah, well, next time.
Mm-hmm.
This is just round one. We're getting ready for round two now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And okay, you know, here's what all good liberals need to do. The next time someone on liberal television or on centrist TV says, this finally proves, I challenge you to shout at your television, proves to who?
Mm-hmm.
Proves to who? Because people who keep insisting that this is the final fact in place that will finally make a difference assumes that there is an audience out there, people who are listening, is still on the fence about these Republicans.
They're the great American center.
Sure. They're not exactly. They're not quite sure who's really to blame here, but they're persuadable. Bullshit. There is no such audience.
Yeah.
There are people on the left who are right. There are people on the right who are wrong. There are people in the center who are cowards.
And they're either cowards or they're just disinterested.
Or they're paid. Yeah. Or they're paid to be there. They're paid to keep shaking up the jar with the red ants and black ants and watching them fight. And saying it's not my job to tell you who's right or wrong.
A very large swath of the American public, Driftglass, that just cares about football and doesn't care about politics.
That's fine.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
But that though, and those people, when they're pushed against the wall to have a political opinion, just err on the side of, well, I'm kind of in the middle and I'm not taking a side.
And do please note.
And then they're celebrated by the media as being the great American center.
Thank God you finally admitted that Rush Limbaugh is as bad as hippies. See, if you're coming, mm-hmm. you're coming halfway at least. It's also worth noting there is a trend. I notice it because I read these things all the time. But this wonderfully obvious trend among expatriate or exiled or disgruntled or cast out conservatives, David Frum, David Brooks, Andrew Sullivan, people like that, to really radically revise history so that they were not ever really wrong.
Yes.
And in David Brooks,
at that point where they have been kicked out of the movement or in some other way.
Now, hardworking reporter David Brooks has been on book leave from the New York Times for the last 3 months, which means a vacation in which he travels around the country giving lectures to people about heroism and stuff like that. But he still goes on television, goes on NPR. Apparently, it's not that much of a task. He had to give up writing 800 words twice a week, which is really hard. I know for David Brooks, it's really, really hard. To go off and lecture and talk, but he still goes on television. And the last time he was on television, he was asked sort of what the hell went wrong? And his answer was, well, it started in the 60s. You know, there was Vietnam and Watergate, and people just lost trust in their government. And then a bunch of stuff happened.
He didn't know why.
He had no idea why things
had gotten wrong. Trust in the government.
But then a bunch of things happened, and he thinks that maybe generally people just started trusting each other less. You know, we just all started trusting each other a little bit less and a little bit less. And then eventually that kind of mistrust infused itself into our institutions like government. Like, really? So impeaching Clinton had nothing to do, or lying us into a war, nothing like that. Iran-Contra. For David Brooks, who, remind you, is
Watergate.
Well, he mentioned Watergate.
Oh, he did.
That's okay. Safely in the 60s and 70s. Okay. That's way
I've got longer. I've got a Watergate story from this week that I have to tell you about.
Let me just wind this up by saying David Brooks is in the process of writing conservative Whig alternate history.
Yeah.
And that's his project. He's creating a completely separate narrative for reasonable Republicans like him, in which fundamentalists never came into the GOP, the right wing never happened, Rush Limbaugh never happened, the Southern strategy did not exist, Reagan did not, and this is all easily verifiable and true. It's just something bad happened. We're not really sure what. It probably was government overreach, maybe liberals promising too much, and then blah, 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 people lost faith with the government, blah, 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 Tea Party. And that's his alternate history. David Frum, on the other hand, who still has a job for reasons that absolutely passeth all understanding, former Bush speechwriter, the guy who created the term axis of evil, puts the date at which conservatism lost its mind at 2009, because that was shortly before conservatism kicked him out. Mm-hmm. And the American, I think, Heritage or American Enterprise, I think it was Heritage Foundation, I'm not really sure which.
I think it was Heritage, yeah.
Cut his paycheck off.
Yeah.
Stopped deciding, yeah, you can still have an office here, but your 100 grand a year salary, that's over. At that moment, he decided, this is, again, my favorite Mark Twain joke. You know, I joined the Confederacy, served for 6 weeks. I deserted and the South fell. You know, I was a part of the conservative movement. They cast me out and then they collapsed. It's this desperate scramble to make sure you have no fingerprints on the monster that you created, that you have no part of it. And the reason it works is these people all are surrounded by people who will never ask them that hard a question and never push them when the subject comes up. David Brooks has Mark Shields, who is a big, soft pile of poo, who is, you know, will reliably wave the liberal flag, but he'll never push his very good friend David Brooks, that he tours around the country with, on, by the way, didn't you used to kick the shit out of hippies and call George Bush a great man and blah, 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 blah? Didn't you used to write, like, really harsh shit before the New York Times started paying your salary? He's never going to ask that question. So those are watching that trend, watching the conservatives frantically rewriting history, along with the Tea Party. The Tea Baggers are rewriting history so that the only problem was we weren't conservative enough. And the expatriate conservatives are rewriting history so the only problem is they didn't listen to us.
And the liberal media cost us this election.
Yeah. And the liberals, meanwhile, do not exist in this spectrum at all. We don't appear anywhere. Only in the narrative.
Imaginary liberal media.
Well, only in the pages from our book that Andrew Sullivan keeps stealing, do liberal thoughts ever appear? But they're always, you know, they have the serial number scratched out.
Yes.
And true conservatism written over it. So you were saying something about
Nixon.
Yeah.
I was driving back from dropping the kids off at school and listening to I don't know. I had the radio on and I don't even know which station it was, but it's some musical station. And they were doing morning drive time news, which is not real news.
Yeah.
All right. It's just this football team did this and here's this funny story about this. And finally, Susie, because, you know, it's a male and a female jocks on morning drive time. Haha, Susie, you can't buy the transcripts of the Nixon White House tapes for Christmas this year. They'll be out next June.
Uh-huh.
And they're finally going to publish all of the transcripts of all of the tapes from the Nixon White House. This is being done in commemoration of the 40th anniversary of Nixon's departure from office.
Yeah.
End of story.
His what now?
Yeah. And now on with the music.
That's what the kids are calling impeached for, nearly impeached,
yeah, near
and had to resign.
Impeachment and resignation in disgrace.
Yeah. He departed, you know.
Yes.
Wow, like Jack Nicholson in that movie, The Departed.
Yeah, right. Where
that kind of departed.
And
that kind of
dead in a dumpster. Yeah, that one.
But it's that we don't want to remember these very unpleasant things about our past.
Yeah.
And once you
start, I'm not saying that this I don't doubt for a minute that this particular radio station ripped this off of their new syndicated stuff.
Oh, no.
That you're supposed to read that they pay a certain amount every week for, and you know, but that means that 300 radio stations said the in commemoration of Nixon's departure from office.
Yeah.
Rather than just this one station. So
it's
out there.
Once you start listening for it, you do start to hear it.
Yeah.
And then you get angry and old and Irish like me.
Absolutely.
So just don't listen for it.
Don't listen. No, you can't help but listen for it once you know it's there. The both-siderism and the whitewashing of the Republican.
And the theft of liberal critiques.
Yeah.
During these brief periods between Republican catastrophe and the Republican catastrophe going down the memory hole, there is a, what I call, I'm now calling Olestra liberalism, which is the artificial version of liberalism without actual liberals involved, which you can say all these mean things about conservatives, but you never have to pay the price on your hips by acknowledging that this is the same shit liberals have been saying for 40 years.
Next week is going to be kind of odd because we have parent-teacher conferences Friday morning. So just so you know, we're probably going to record it a little early and it won't be as timely as it often is. So we got a great letter. I want to end today with a little brief sentence from Timothy. Not the Bible chapter.
Is this 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy?
No, this is, yes, the epistle from Timothy. Just our listener Timothy wrote to us and said, I listen to you guys every week. And every week, my 11-year-old daughter rolls her eyes and sighs. Oh, great. The Fuck You podcast.
You're a terrible parent, Timothy.
Ah, well, Drift Class, there's no accounting for taste. Personally, I find that expletives used regularly and with deliberation and purpose add a spice to political discourse, which it desperately needs these days. Thank you, Timothy.
Thank you, Timothy,
and your contributions and all that good stuff. Thank you. And hi to your 11-year-old daughter. She's right. We don't like the swears. Okay. No. Every week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Dewey. Dewey as in the Dewey Decimal System, but not the famous Dewey. There is actually an entire book about Dewey the cat, the librarian cat. That's not this one. This is just Dewey, who is out enjoying a lovely fall day. I hope everyone gets a chance to do that this autumn. We've had some lovely fall days here.
We have.
Southern Illinois. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. We do love hearing from you. Please feel free to write us and be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air unless you say otherwise. So, hey, Drift Class, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties are hanging on to their doomsday prepper kits until next November.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2013, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
I have a lovely letter that we received 2 weeks ago, just about 2 weeks ago, from Mike, and I'd like to read the whole thing. It's not all Science Fiction University, but it's mostly Science Fiction University.
Is it flattering and deferential?
Well, you listen to it. See what you think. I thought it was very moving. Let me put it that way. Hi, Blue Gal. First, let me say I love your podcast. The combination of candid political opinion and science fiction is such a perfect mix and such a great way to spend an hour. I have an iPod full of podcasts, and yours is one of my must-listen-to as soon as it downloads. It is one of my favorites, along with Young Turks and Jimmy Dore and The Majority Report. And thank you very much for that, Mike. We like being held up to those folks. That's great.
Whoever they are.
Majority Report who? Sam Cedar who?
What?
I do love your political opinions and insight. Thankfully, they agree with mine most of the time, and I love the science fiction discussion. But another part of your podcast is touching also. I was listening to your podcast while grocery shopping yesterday, and you had me in tears. You have talked about your sisters and their experience with breast cancer and your family history with it. I lost my wife to breast cancer after a 4-year battle, so your talk about that really touches me. On your last political podcast, though, you and Drift Class exchanged very sincere thank yous and I love yous. And it just tore right into the gaping hole in my soul. I'm a very militant atheist, but not sure what other word to use. That just had me welling up while grocery shopping for me and my 14-year-old son. Sorry, tearing up again just writing about it. That's very moving, Mike. Thank you. And he gave me permission to read this on the air, by the way.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah. And as I wrote back to him, cancer sucks. There's no other way to put it. Anyways, on to the science fiction part of it. I don't have a specific question to try to stump Driftglass with, but would love his opinion. and to hear him pontificate on science fiction as a canary in the coal mine. We are ignoring as they die. I remember reading stories by Heinlein and others, though Heinlein comes to mind first. I read about an America much more totalitarian and much more of a police state, and wondered how we could ever possibly go from the free society I thought we had in my younger days. I will be 50 in a couple months. Now I see it happening, and I wonder how anyone who has ever read any science fiction doesn't see it happening. Another common theme in science fiction is when there is time travel. So often the tall, skinny, green alien with a big head and no genitals is someone from our future, coming back to try to save the species because they can no longer reproduce.
I've written that story a few times myself.
I wondered how we could ever get there, that we would sicken ourselves so much that our species can no longer sustain itself. Now we have food and agribusiness and pharmaceutical companies buying the right from our Congress to poison us. We are poisoning our water with fracking. I can't remember if it were old Westerns or the Basil Rathbone version of Sherlock Holmes during World War II, but it seemed like all the big bad guys wanted to do was poison the water supply. They were the bad guys and the evil spies then, and they are the corporate heroes and pillars of society today. Finally, the science fiction analysis of the natural state of human society. As I watch our country, the only superpower left, turning into a Mad Max let him die world, I wonder how artificial our dream society really is. I think of P.J. Farmer's River World or the Mad Max movies, suggesting that the natural state of human societies is that of cut through every man for himself, and the idea of America was doomed to failure, and it has failed from the very beginning. Sorry this is so long. If you use this for the podcast, feel free to edit at will. Your podcast is smart, funny, a little red meat for the base, and touching, at least to me. So my financial support is on the way, and I will continue to relish your podcast on a weekly basis. Sincerely, Mike. Okay.
Thank you, Mike. That's really nice. What a good way to start a Thursday.
Yeah, and he brought up a lot of stuff about science fiction and politics and current politics and so forth. And I'd just like to invite you to riff on that, and I'll respond as I can. How about that?
Well, there's science fiction if you go to my blog, you'll see that from Ray Bradbury, I don't try to predict the future, I try to prevent it. And there's an awful lot in science fiction that goes along with that cautionary tale. The earliest science fiction, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, was a cautionary tale. It's all about things that human beings shouldn't be doing. And the core question of science fiction is what if? One of the early science fiction stories is, if this goes on, that's always the question. The question is, if you take a trend, any trend, psychological, technological, media, whatever it is, and just keep projecting it out and out and out into the future, what is the logical outcome of that trend? And that is basically what science fiction does. It asks a lot of questions about tomorrow, and if this goes on, what happens tomorrow? And the problem with writing science fiction these days is a lot of those themes are now interwoven. Because you have, it's not one thing that's changing, it's everything that's changing simultaneously and interactively, so that there's this great chaotic confusion about what the future looks like. But one of the themes of science fiction is money usually wins. Big money usually wins. William Gibson wrote really well about this and still writes well about this. The idea that the next logical stage in human evolution, in a sense, is the corporation. Can't die. It outlives, you know, the mafia, the church, and corporations will live forever because you can't kill them. Robert Heinlein wrote, I think it was in Job, A Comedy of Justice, the fact that you can't nuke IBM. Their corporations have headquarters, but they don't have nation states to defend. They don't have borders to defend. They can move anywhere. Capital can move anywhere. So people who are bound by ideology and geography will always be beaten by people who are purely capitalist, who are purely willing to invest in something that will make them more money and enhance their personal power for the foreseeable future. Sometimes that's the next quarter. I think the loss of royal families, in a sense, has screwed us up, because corporations don't care about the next generation of the president of the company. It doesn't care about your kids, because fuck your kids. You know, I don't care if they have to drink polluted water. That's their problem. I'll figure out a way. I'll have enough money. I'll buy my own island. So the idea that you tie the fate of the powerful to the fate of the powerless is now something that you can just opt out of. You don't have to worry about those people. Those people live on a different planet as far as you're concerned. Ultimately, we all are stuck on this planet together.
Yeah, yeah. I think of some of the funny examples of that, not to get all Pollyannish, but in Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood, she takes things in terms of genetic engineering to their logical conclusion. And it turns out that, I mean, I'm not going to give away any core plot point in the story, but one of the things that they generate at the Watson Crick Institute, which is the school of these super intelligent men, mostly, who do genetic engineering, is they engineer a chicken that is all breast. Yeah. And has no legs and no head and no wings and is just two breasts with a hole at the top where you feed it. And the way she writes it, it is very, very funny. This headless, legless, two chicken breasts with feathers on the outside, and they're dumping food in the top of these chicken holes.
Yeah.
Because why? They don't need any other part of the chicken except the breast meat. That's all they want.
The flip side of that, and I know I've mentioned this book before, it's sort of a touchstone for me, is The Space Merchants.
Yes, yes.
In The Space Merchants, there was the chicken heart.
Yep.
Which is the giant blob of protein that everyone lived off of. And,
yep, and carve and off of it a little bit. And
yeah. The peons who worked for the corporation that ran the place would walk around it and carve off the right pieces at the right time, which would be processed into food. And the peons at the corporation all were technically there of their own volition, but they'd signed contracts. And their contracts demanded that they buy from the company's store, which meant they were never going to get out of debt. They basically drink from the company soda fountain, which was drugged. So it kept them addicted.
Yep.
And the person who, our protagonist, was a copywriter at the beginning, the copy editor, the very top of the social pyramid. And was cast down from his position into the world he had created and was horrified because all the things that he had sort of blithely tossed off as important, like the general downward trend in human IQ that was being brought on by bombarding people with advertising and filling them full of crap. Mm-hmm. He didn't understand why that was a bad thing. You know, the stupider people get, the easier it is to sell to them.
It's easier to advertise, yes.
And therefore, it makes my job easier. And since advertising is an unqualified good, which is what he believed, and since advertising is the great democratizing...
Because he was Mad Men. He was that guy. Yeah.
And corporations and capitalism was the great democratizing force in the world that would make everyone equal and make everyone happy and make everyone... Every need would be satisfied by advertising. He didn't understand why having people get stupider was a bad thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And who cares about pollution? You know, we'll take care of it. Your life is better because you can drink, you know, you can eat Popsy and drink coffee est.
Yeah.
And if it's a little bit addictive, well, so what? The scientists who say that, we'll buy them off. Mm-hmm. And it was a person who lived completely inside of a ultra wealthy reality bubble. Mm-hmm. Where they didn't have to pay the price for anything they did.
Yeah.
And they had invented an entirely internally consistent ideology that said everything I do is perfectly justified.
What I love about that book, too, is and I hope people will go read The Space Merchants. It's an easy read and it's fun to read.
1954, 58. Yeah. This is written
Frederick
half
Pohl,
a century
P-O-H-L.
Ago.
P-O-H-L.
Yeah. I want to underscore this is written half a century ago.
And it's still
half a century
so pertinent.
Ago.
So pertinent. But I love the part where, and no spoilers, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a part where he meets up with some people that are politically different from him.
Yes.
Or from the old him.
Yeah.
And he can't help himself but to tell. Them, your advertising approach is all wrong.
Which it was.
And how to fix it. Yeah.
Which it was. He
you can't
actually
take the ad man out of anything that he does. And I won't give any more away.
The thing that science fiction does, ironically enough, is to remind people of alternate versions of how reality could be. Mm-hmm. And also remind them that people have been warning about certain problems for a very, very long time. This is not a new thing at all. And the question, this is again more of our political podcast.
I kind of want to combine this because I think, as I said to Mike, that his question really is more appropriate for a regular podcast than Science Fiction University. But go right ahead.
The question, the challenge, and my level of frustration at this point is very high. This is going to color this podcast. I mean, certain things about the last couple of weeks have been very frustrating.
Yes.
The number of people who have been warning in increasing degrees of alarm that bad thing A, B, or C, which is completely predictable, is coming and is now here, are suffering exactly the same fate as the sheriff in Jaws. Mm-hmm. Or Steve McQueen in the movie version of An Enemy of the People. We're the pariahs. We're the people who've been trying to warn that the Republican Party has lost its mind, or the planet is burning, or, you know what, supply-side economics is a really terrible idea. Write down the list of the things that are now all exploding all around us. You will find a group of people on the left who have been warning about this for a fucking generation.
Yeah. Well, and I was looking up The Handmaid's Tale while you were talking. The Handmaid's Tale is almost 30 years old, which just makes me feel ancient. But her idea is, as Mike brought up in his letter, that human fertility has been affected by pollution and you know, all of the corporate activities, and that leaves the door open for the churches to begin to control women, and women's lives become purely useful for reproduction. If they're able to reproduce, they are just reduced to that function, and every woman in this society then is just assigned a function and given no freedom whatsoever. And to me, that totalitarian theocracy that, you know, Ted Cruz is talking about, and the woman who lost her mind at the House floor yesterday is talking about, the very real stuff going on.
Well,
I interrupted you.
No, absolutely not.
The fact that it's 30 years old. This happened, you know, this book was published in 85.
I would point out that in 1953, Robert Heinlein wrote The Revolt in 2100, which is about the totalitarian takeover of the United States government by the prophet Nehemiah Scooter, who reigned in a totalitarian, absolute dictatorship until he was overthrown. But it's after the collapse of society, the rise of
I haven't read that. Is that a specifically Christian government?
As I recall, it is, but I don't really remember. It might be an offshoot of his religion from Stranger in a Strange Land. I don't recall the connection between the two. Okay. The Fosterites of that book. But it was definitely a Native American religion. With its own lonesome roads, its own scallywag, its own prophet who takes over the country and institutes massive totalitarian theocratic rule over the United States. This is the theme of Parable of the Sower by Octavia Butler. Yeah. Yeah. This is not exactly new stuff. This is why when I used to give that book to people who were politically active,
you gave it to me and I couldn't finish it.
It's hard. It's not fiction. This is what's happening right now. And so there's a certain degree of Cassandra-like frustration that I feel when I read science fiction, or I feel when I read newspapers these days.
Yes, right.
Because Cassandra did not end well.
No.
Cassandra got the shit kicked out of her for being right. And eventually, as I recall, she ended up in a sack nailed to a door. Mm-hmm. And her curse was to be right all the time.
Yeah.
And nobody believed her. And then when it turned out she was right, she got the hell beaten out of her. So there's all of this really, and again, it's not prophetic. It's not intended to be predictive. It's intended to be entertainment with something of a cautionary thread through it. And, you know, 80% of science fiction is just good fun. But the stuff where you can really kind of see a deeper message in there, and there is plenty of it, is always trying to warn people. You know, Fahrenheit 451, please don't institute a society where we end up burning books. That would be a very bad thing. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to ever penetrate. And those books get put on a shelf in a library, either under literature or classics or under science fiction or under horror, and ignored. And then what was warned and predicted and labored over, this is the thing that just irritates me as a writer, labored over for months or years by the writers who picked just exactly the right word and chose just the right sentence and really worked hard on them. And they're read and they're put on a shelf, and then along comes the thing they warned you about, and everyone runs around with their hair on fire going, oh my God, who could have predicted that a bunch of theocrats would take over a major political party in the United States and run into the ground? And, well, pretty much everyone on the left for the last 40 years, that's who, and you didn't listen. And that's, again, my level of frustration shining through that there's some, that they're shocked to discover gambling is going on here.
Yeah.
Shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked. But and I would never give up on the literature of science fiction. It is the best in it is uplifting and humane and provides a positive view of the future. And however frustrated I may be week in or week out, overall, I'm extremely I'm pro human. I'm pro future.
Well, see, that's why we're not going to do a Walking Dead podcast, because I personally, I know you like that show, but I can't stand it. And I can't stand it for a very specific reason. I can't stand it because there doesn't seem to be an inkling of a cure anywhere in the story to give anyone hope. I was thinking about Justin Cronin's soon-to-be trilogy. He's got two of the books out. But in the first book, you are told in the first three pages that there is a girl who is there to save the world.
Yeah.
And she's a central character, and she goes on, and she does a lot of things, and things happen to her and so forth. And I do recommend that people read that. I've read the first two so far. What is the name of that book?
The Passages?
The Passage. That's the Passage. Right. Yeah. The first one is The Passage. And you're just told right away at the beginning, this is the girl who will save the world. And given that, you're willing to follow along to see how it's going to end and how will she get overcome all of these this adversity. That's not there in Walking Dead as far as I can see it. I mean, I get the virtue of humanity clinging to life and fighting it. But even in Justin Cronin's book, that when they kill the bad guys, who are Walking Dead characters, by the way, they're not zombie, but they're like that. It's considered the mercy. I mean, it's a job that you do, and there's no joy in it, but you actually acknowledge the humanity of that former person and kill them, knowing that you are mercifully ending their torment.
Right.
And I don't get that when people stab through the head in Walking Dead. Some of them enjoy it way too much.
Yeah.
And that creeps me out. And
well, there's an absolute foundation for this. This is in a lot of science fiction. The Stand, I'm thinking of specifically, is, you know.
Well, and a lot of people have compared Justin Cronin to The Stand as well. Yeah.
And The Stand was a pretty good book. I liked it. It went on a bit too long. I like Stephen King. I still think 100 years from now, if we're still around, people will be reading some of Stephen King like they read Charles Dickens.
Yeah.
Because he took these really intricate snapshots of American life during a certain period that were very, very accurate. Mm-hmm. And some of his stuff is just silly. But he's written a million things, so really, stop being pedantic about it. but the upshot being that there is this theme in a lot of fiction that, yeah, once the disaster happens, the initial disaster is the comet hitting the Earth or the zombie apocalypse or whatever it is. The secondary disaster is the fact that you find out that about half the people on this Earth are awful. And vicious. Yeah. And they're
willing to cooperate with evil for their own advantage. Right.
Absolutely. Right. And the alien invasion stories are, you'll usually find a faction of human beings who are willing to ally with the aliens.
The governor in Walking Dead is.
Yeah, and even in Babylon 5.
Of this. Yeah.
Even in Babylon 5, once the shadows are swept from the galaxy, once the bad guys are gone, you find out that the Earth government has been completely riddled with bad people who are perfectly willing to destroy the planet in order to fulfill prophecy.
Yeah.
And so there's a certain clarifying moment that comes that, oh, the real villain aren't, I forget what the movie was. It was Unbreakable with Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. I'm not going to spoil it for you other than to say, and it was an M. Night Shyamalan movie that was, you know, meh. It was okay, not bad. But it was Samuel Jackson explaining that in comic books, there are always two villains. The first is the physical villain who threatens the hero physically. Those are your zombies. The second is the villain of the mind, the real villain, the power behind the power. And the zombies, to me, are always in these, are always in the foreground. They're always the constant, immediate physical threat. And they provide the palette on which the rest of the story is told, which is, and among the survivors, you find that the most ruthless, terrible people did really well during the apocalypse.
Yep.
Actually, it reminds me, I hate to go one more over, but it reminds me of what, who was it? It was in Failsafe. Walter Matthau's character, you know, who was basically Irving Kristol, you know, the original neocon, the guy who was urging President Henry Fonda to go ahead and do a full nuclear strike against the Russians before they could figure out what was coming, because that's what you do to bad people. I learned from the Nazis. Oh, yes, I did. And but his theory that after the bomb goes off, there'll be two groups of people who survive. And those would be file clerks who were insulated by boxes of paper, and prisoners who were insulated by concrete. And what would happen when these two groups finally emerged from the rubble, developed their own cultures, and came into conflict with each other?
Mm-hmm.
So that is always the entertaining and interesting part of it, is once you've compelled people into their most extreme state by physical danger, what do they do? And how close a thing it always is that the bad guys win, because they always seem better organized and better funded. Anyway, that's my science fiction ramble for this week.
Well, I just want to tell you something about Cassandra that will blow your mind.
Yes. She was a blogger?
Well, no, but two bloggers have pointed out that Homeland is the story of Cassandra and Apollo.
Oh, yeah.
Really interesting. No one believes Carrie until she's proven right. And
right.
Apollo is, yeah, it just makes sense when I think about it. Like, whoa, yeah, that's right. Okay.
Is there a Breaking Bad tie-in, too? Because that'd be awesome.
We've been watching old episodes. And by the way, thank you to the person who anonymously, I don't know whether he intended to send us something anonymously, sent us some DVDs this week. If you sent us DVDs this week, please write us and let us know who you are. We got this letter inserted saying, don't contact me. I'm out of town until November 4th. Mm-hmm. And that was it. No signature. I figured it was Damian Lewis. It had to be.
Thank you, Damian. You're welcome.
But thank you for that. And we've been watching old seasons of Homeland and catching up with that.
I'm waiting for the episode of Homeland where Saul says,
I'm sorry, Carrie. That every episode.
But he finally breaks character, and he tells us his real name. You know, he's been undercover all this time, and his real name is Diego Montoya. And you killed his father. Prepare to die.
And then Damian Lewis runs in and says, I am Kaiser Soze.
Meet my new baby girl daughter. What? She's a chick? He's a chick? She's a guy? And he's dead? And he has a sled?
Apple.
What?
And then you wake up. You're talking to Suzanne Plachette about these woodsmen in this weird dream you had. All right.
And you were there, and you, and I'm just you, most of all. All right, darling.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.